Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue to provide you the content, we're hopefully giving you the information that will improve our, you know, learning, pray, act, you know, motto of getting smart, you know, intelligence is power, those types of things, and invoking in an appeal to heaven to ask for those specific blessings that we need to be able to turn things around. As a matter of fact, that kind of brings up, you know, a point that I've kind of been laying out that I just want to share real quick with you, is this concept that our forefathers were righteous men. Yeah, they were. But God didn't bless them because they were righteous men. He didn't create this nation because they were righteous men. He blessed them because they acted in faith. In other words, folks, the only reason we're being held, or the blessings from heaven are being withheld from the nation, is not enough of us are acting to where those types of blessings can come. I can tell you, as I've lived my life, I can only thank him for all of the blessings I've received, the knowledge that he's given me. This is all for his glory. But the fact is, folks, that it's not whether you're righteous or not, it's whether you're acting upon those righteous principles. And bottom line, he blessed our forefathers. Why? Because they took a stand for humanity in a righteous capacity. How was that? It was about liberty. The cause of liberty blesses humanity, not just themselves. That's why the divine hand of providence didn't just bless the Puritans, didn't just bless the Anglicans, didn't just bless the Baptists. He blessed them as they worked together in the cause of liberty. You need to understand this. The reason why we keep saying learn, pray, act is that's how the windows of heaven will be opened. And then when he blesses us, we need to sanctify those things by continuing to act in a greater capacity. That's how it works. Am I wrong, Sean?
No, you're absolutely right.
Okay. So hopefully that helps you understand that the reason we're being tossed to and fro, we see all of these biblical things happening and we're still in the rut, is because we as a people are not acting and uniting. I'm here, and you know what? I know people hate me because I call them out. And even though I am a man, and we all have our, none of us are perfect. As a matter of fact, if the requirement to go to church was perfection, then none of us could go to church. If the requirement to get to heaven was to be perfect, we wouldn't make it. Which is one of the reasons why we have an intercession on our behalf. And he provided that. The fact is, folks, is that we have to stop being this torched earth attitude of going after people because they're not perfect. We have to accept the fact that we're all a work in progress. And stop working, or stop saying, I'm not working with those folks. Stop holding another person's faith. I mean, it's one thing if there may be a Mohammedan. I can see that we don't want to have war with them, even though they've declared war against us. The reality is that's what they've done. But what we need to do is acknowledge the fact that their ideology is incompatible with our way of life and our legal system that we have here in America. They can't be citizens. All of these people talking about, you know, these little things of deporting and so forth, they're bypassing the rudimentary real problem. A Mohammedan cannot abjure their allegiance to their potent, to their ideology of Mohammedan, or I should say Islam, which is why they demand Sharia law while they're citizens of the United States, when they're supposed to be supporting the Constitution and the rule of law. They are a direct conflict. They can't be citizens. So I don't care if we allow Mohammedans to live here, you know, as non-citizens, but they can never be citizens. And, you know, the framers, their attitude was, don't even bring him here. Why allow that problem to persist? Because look at everywhere else in the world. We're the only nation, by the way, folks, I hope you understand this. We're the only nation, because of our citizenship standards, that you have to support the Constitution, that makes it impossible for them to be citizens here. They can be a citizen of the UK because they don't have that same standard. Is that not divine providence? Is that not showing the DNA of the Lord knew what we would need, and we basically created the framework based on what he gave us? So any thoughts on that, Sean?
Yes, it gets more beautiful every time I hear you explain it further.
You know what? It's
funny because I was just working on an article. I'm probably going to publish it tomorrow on our website about this very case. Tommy Tuberville is now doing a performance about banning Sharia law. And I was like, you don't have to make a law to ban Sharia law. It's unconstitutional. It can't be in the United States under the Constitution.
That's right. And you've got it right.
What you're saying makes sense, because I've heard other people talk about how Islam is not compatible with the United States Constitution. So when the founders talked about religion, they weren't even talking about Islam as a religion.
Well, so
they were talking about it. They didn't consider it a religion.
So here's an interesting thing. Because actually, in the South Carolina debates, they actually wander into Mohammedism. And they basically, the governor of South Carolina says, I actually see, because at this point in time, they didn't have the oath of citizenship. These things didn't really start taking form under this divine constitution. As things actually started forming under the federal government, those layers of protection were automatically happening, where you had to be, you know, you had to have full allegiance to the Constitution as a naturalized citizen. That actually started right out the gate. So it made it impossible for Mohammedans or anybody that had a false allegiance, you know, and where their true allegiance was with something else, that those people would lose their citizenship just like this. So in South Carolina, the governor says, I think it's even possible if enough Mohammedans come here, we may actually have a Mohammedan president. He didn't understand the Constitution and how this was going to lay out. So this only shows you that many of the men that were involved in the Constitution did not see all of the magnitude of the divine nature of this document. Only a few men had a better vision of it, but even still, they didn't understand that what they received was his plan of globalism, of how all people could live in a land of liberty and be able to receive the truth of him and his son and accept that and actually become a citizen in that faith while they're still participating as a citizen of this great nation or this great union, and still be, you know, I'll just say, you know, in harmony between these two citizenships. Nowhere else do you find this. Nowhere else. So, because remember, at that point in time, all other nations were theocracies. Every nation out there was a theocracy. They had... Right.
That's what I was just going to comment, that in the UK, you had to be in that denomination.
If you were going to be in specific
offices... You'd be a Christian
offices.
Outside of yes. their yes. official denomination, because then you were discriminated against. You didn't have the same rights
right.
as the people who were.
Yes, correct.
And under the Constitution... You can be of any denomination as long as you're, you know, and the righteousness comes from your own actions under the law.
Okay, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you cannot be the prime minister of the UK if you're not a member of the Anglican Church. And you have to be basically coronated by the Archbishop of Canterbury. I mean, even to this day, there are still those hard ties, even in Britain. Now, before we turn, because we need to get back into the Constitution, I want to say this, because one of the things that actually came out in the turn of the 20th century was the attack upon our forefathers, and more specifically, the framers, were being attacked. One of the things that came out was, you know, the George Washington diary, you know, oh, he was a deist. There was a lot of misinformation. And we have to remember that the guys that were rewriting history, they were doing everything they could to hide the truths, to ensure that their narrative would stand as a derogatory narrative against our founders. So that being said, there were these things, and I remember that I learned in the 70s or the 60s, where George Washington in his diary grew hemp. And he actually made a comment in his diary that he couldn't, you know, he was, I think, either in battle or what have you, in the Revolutionary War, or maybe in the Ohio's fighting Indians, where he made a comment, I can't wait to get home so I can smoke some of my homegrown hemp. Because they didn't like tobacco. As a matter of fact, tobacco was inflicted upon them because of the mercantile system of Britain, and the only reason they grew it was they were forced to grow it. And because it depleted the soil, it just destroyed the soil, where you couldn't grow anything else. It took a long time for that soil to recuperate. And so, you know, there were all these little things. But the interesting thing, and folks, I'm just giving you this to think about. Every framer has been attacked. Madison is one that, you know, there's not a lot of attack on Madison because he wasn't larger than life. You know, the Constitution, him being the father of the Constitution, elevated him, and the Constitution became larger than him. But there was really very little that they could do about James Madison in disparaging his character, other than he had slaves. The reality is Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, many of the framers, in one way or another, were basically baked into bad light. The only framer that, as far as I know, was never baked into bad light is Alexander Hamilton. And he was the one guy that was legitimately caught in a torrid affair with, you know, a married woman, and the husband sat there and watched in his adulterous affair. I mean, Hamilton was just a bad player. And if anybody that they could disparage, why didn't they disparage him? And why is it that the progressive left have this honoring play, Hamilton, to make this guy larger than life? Because he was the guy that gave us the undermining Federalist Papers that allowed the federal government to make the perception based on this Federalist, you know, paradigm that the courts could do these things, and it got the courts out of the genie bottle because nobody was challenging what the Federalist Papers were saying. The Federalist Papers were injected into a position as the standard of understanding the Constitution instead of the ratification base. When Madison spent his entire life pointing to and telling people, you've got to read the ratification debates. And ergo, that is why Hamilton has been elevated and focused, because he was the guy that gave them what they needed to literally defile this Constitution was given to us. He was the guy that was responsible for defiling and subverting our Constitutional Republic. And yet all the other framers, they're, you know, they may be personal attacks because, you know, Jefferson, you know, had not an affair, but he had conversations. He kind of suited a married woman. There was never any proof that they ever, you know, acted in an intimate way. But it still, in those days, was bad enough that he actually had private conversations with a married woman. And he admitted to doing that. So when we look at how they've attacked the Constitution by attacking the men involved, and yet the guy that was the dirtiest scoundrel has been elevated and they brushed everything under the rug. That tells you how the Constitution is that divine, as far as I'm concerned, because they're trying to castigate this based on the imperfections of people, which is kind of why I started. If we have to be perfect, we would never make it. These men weren't perfect. But because we are so critical, oh, that person had an affair, that person had an inappropriate conversation, and we scorch the earth because the allegation is there. Instead, we should actually be looking to say, you know, let's not look at the men, let's look at what they did. Let's look at this document. And as we examine this document, we can see this document surpasses the capacity and the comprehension of these men combined. They didn't see, they didn't understand. And the 14th Amendment was that one critical brick that needed to get into the Constitution where we would have full accountability. And then look what happened. The next election after the 14th Amendment, enough radical Republicans in 1870, enough radical Republicans, because the 14th Amendment wasn't ratified until 1868, right? And so once it got ratified and everybody saw what this amendment was doing, the radical Republicans were removed by British money in that election. And ergo, we've never looked back. Everybody, they've created and castigated the 14th Amendment just like they have elevated Hamilton. We're being manipulated, and they continuously have manipulated us into taking the narrative that they've wanted us. And we see this, and Sean and I and other people have these constant conversations with the nationalists out there that are constantly disparaging the 14th Amendment, but they're embracing, you know, these court rulings, and they're embracing the judiciary form of government that the courts created. And I'm going, what? So I digress. What I wanted to do was I wanted to help people understand the divine nature and really start looking at how this Constitution was written and how it delegated the very specific roles and responsibilities. Those things not delegated, they can't do. So anyway, hopefully that gets us. Any other comments or anything else you want to add, Sean, before we move on?
No, I mean, last time when we left off,
yeah,
or after we recorded, I had a question about this last section we went through and the connection to the sovereign citizens,
yes,
and
go
American
ahead.
National movement, uh-huh, where it talks about all cases affecting ambassadors.
Yep, in all cases to admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. Uh-huh. Yep.
Maritime jurisdiction. Because yes. I hear a lot of them talking about, oh, when you go into court, that's maritime law and you're not under maritime law. And
yeah,
I never really understood exactly what they were talking about. I mean, I kind of get the premise, but I didn't understand where they got that from. And you had mentioned that this part wasn't included in the Articles of Confederation, and that made me think that's why they all, you know, have this sacrosanct thing about the Articles of Confederation.
Well, so it might be in the Articles of Confederation, but the reality is that the states were actually conducting their own cases. They were assuming jurisdiction over admiralty and maritime law. And so that's why they were creating their own treaties. That's why they were working the legal ease of how to do foreign exchange and so forth with other nations. And other nations were loving it because they were getting advantages out of the big players. And it was hurting the little players. I could go through the Articles of Confederation to say definitively that they didn't include this. The fact is that because they didn't have a standing judiciary, what they had was Continental Congress. They didn't have a court. Continental Congress would have to decide if they needed to create a court and who they would appoint as the judge. That's why when you really look at the judicial side of the Articles of Confederation, they couldn't immediately engage in any legal matter. Where having a full-time judiciary, that's what they would do, and as soon as a matter would come up, it would go straight into the court that existed at the time. They didn't have that under the Articles of Confederation, where they actually had courts in the states because they had full-time judiciaries. Now, does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And does that correlate to Article 1, Section 10 about what the states are not allowed to do? Agreements, compacts with another
Correct.
State or foreign
Correct.
Power.
Yes, that's another restriction placed upon the states. And here's the power granted to the federal judiciary that only right. those cases would be there. In other words, all of these things created a hard barrier for the states to be able to get involved in international legal situation. Period.
Correct.
And so, what it did was it basically forced the states out of the international arena, and the federal government, this is why Hamilton, or actually it was Madison that stated this, when you look at the federal government, it functioned externally, outward. In other words, it was to deal with the foreign nations and to protect us with national security and a national defense system. It had no powers to intermingle within the states. It only had some limited powers to dealing with Indian nations that weren't taxed. That's it. That was it in dealing with commerce with Indian nations. Therefore, as we kind of move forward in, you know, this federal compact, you know, arena, the states were able to, you know, operate in their own little protected world. And whenever they had a problem, the federal government was to protect their sovereignty in dealing with those foreign nations. And actually, by doing that, it gave everybody a better advantage because it was one for, at that point in time, 13, 16, however many states were in the Union, there was one case that handled all of the international dealings with the trade problems amongst these states and foreign nations. In other words, it had a greater effect because it was supported by all of the states instead of dealing with one state to the next state to the next state, which watered down the jurisdiction and power that that court, the perception that the power of that court had with the world. You know, oh, well, you're just dealing with one state over there when there's, you know, 17 courts that they have, because at that point in time, if the Union didn't exist, then it would literally be, you know, one of many instead of one of all. In other words, one for all, one court for all of the states, which got the backing of all of the states. Madison basically stated that when you really look at how the Constitution was formed, it was formed by the sovereignty of the states, and therefore it gave dignity to the Constitution as well as those functions that were delegated to that federal government. So hopefully that helps, and hopefully where we left off was we talked about to the controversies to which the United States shall be a party, right?
Correct.
And yes. And then the next one is to controversies between two or more states. Now, what you may have may not actually be, you know, italicized properly, but you'll notice that the next clause to the next semicolon is italicized.
Between state and citizens of another state.
Yeah. Modified. So that's italicized. Okay, right. But the reality is the next part is also italicized between citizens of a different state. And then the next part, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, that also is italicized, and between a state and the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects, that also is italicized. That should be. In the Constitution you may be using, I may not have gotten to that. I think I did this. If you're using the violations, I had not italicized. I italicized this in the enumerations of, you know, a little while ago. Because I realize we're going into break, but we'll go into the 11th Amendment in tandem to this part, because we have to, because the 11th Amendment took the jurisdiction regarding these types of controversies away from the federal court. Now, when we look at this, the federal court is actually taking jurisdiction over these, and that's in violation of the 11th Amendment. And we'll explain how they did this and how this problem unraveled. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so because the rest of this part of this paragraph is all italicized, I need to show you how it's all italicized. So let me pull up the 11th Amendment, and I will actually have this part of the Constitution in my view as well. So let me go to the 11th Amendment, and then we'll read the 11th Amendment, or I'll read it for you. And this is what it says. And so what we can do is we can highlight those parts that are basically saying the same thing. Because when you read this, and let me read this first out of Article 3, between a state and citizens of another state. That's kind of just a general, any type of controversy. Let me go down to something that's just a little bit below that to say, between citizens of the same state claiming land grants under claiming lands under grants of different states. That's saying the exact same thing, but it's very specific, right? In other words, between a state and citizens of another state. This is between citizens of the same state claiming land grants of different states. So in other words, those land grants are affecting the jurisdiction of a citizen of the same state in addition to another state. And so it's the same thing as between a citizen and between a state and citizens of another state. And between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens or subjects. So that right there basically says it's another way of saying between a citizen of another state and or a foreigner of a different state, they can't construe jurisdiction between those types of cases. So in other words, when you really put it under this, you know, what they were saying in these types of cases, the federal court shall not construe its jurisdiction to extend to any type of case between a citizen of one state and a case between a different state and or a foreigner. So let's read what the 11th Amendment says. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. In this one clause, they basically swiped at all four of those, or five, whatever, let's see, one, two, three, four, basically three or four different clauses you got there. But they're just basically saying that the federal government cannot get involved in issues between citizens of one state with another state. In other words, where a citizen can actually pull another state into a federal court, or a foreigner can come in and sue a state and pull them into a foreign court, because that's what they say here. That it should not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by a citizen of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. In other words, it's keep your hands off. This is for us to resolve and us alone. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what we're basically saying here is that from the last part that they have legitimate jurisdiction in this paragraph ends with to controversies between two or more states. Everything else following that is all italicized and has been modified by the 11th Amendment. Now, when we look, we actually see the federal court actually having jurisdiction in conflict with the 11th Amendment. What the heck happened? The Supreme Court used the 14th Amendment to basically extend and actually wiped out the 11th Amendment when the 14th Amendment didn't do that. So what happened was the court used the 14th Amendment to redefine it. They took the 14th Amendment, redefined it to a way where they could actually take and attack the 11th Amendment and marginalize it so that they could assume all those cases again. Does that make sense?
I understand it, but it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so you actually have to get into the particular cases where the Supreme Court or a federal court basically made a ruling in redefining what the 14th Amendment says. And by redefining it that way, it basically annihilated. In other words, they're saying that the 14th Amendment annihilated the 11th Amendment. When you read the 11th Amendment, it didn't even touch the 11th Amendment. It didn't touch it at all. And this is where I believe in the 14th Amendment, they're talking more specifically regarding, I'm going to try to take the venture here. When you're looking into Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, it talks about the nor state shall be to deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny any person within the jurisdiction equal protection of the laws. I believe that it was those, either the due process or equal protection, that they redefined in a case here and a case there and a case here and a case there, so that they created this maze of rulings. Again, case law and precedence is not allowed under this Constitution, but they already assumed it in the 1830s. And the federal courts and the states, nobody stepped up and said, hey, that's not within your constitutional jurisdiction. You can't do that. You have to judge each case on its merits, on the law and fact, period. Because nobody pushed back, they're getting away with using case law and precedents. And because these rulings made these decisions, nobody actually, you know, challenged what they put in their opinions, that they could redefine these things. This is how they basically are making up their entire world to basically have full control over anything under the sun. That makes sense, I hope.
Yes, sir.
It's almost,
I see the date that it was ratified, 1798. What was the impetus for this amendment?
I'd need to go back into the history. I looked it up a long time ago, and with all of the dumb things that I have in my head, it's one of those things that I forget the case and why. But all, you know, this is when the states really said, you know what, we had a problem with this in the ratification debates, and we're going to nip this in the bud. And we're going to create an amendment that literally wipes out all those last things. We do not want the federal government to get in between us and dealings with our citizens in our state or citizens of another state specifically, to allow any person of another state or a foreign state to start waging lawfare against us as a state. Because that's what those clauses literally did. Empowering the federal government to start, you know, taking cases on to going after these states. And they said, you know what, that's why that 11th Amendment was very short and sweet, because it basically dealt with all of those stanzas at the very end there. Okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. So now we go to the next paragraph where it details a little bit more regarding the jurisdiction in refining, and I think this is where they get into appellate trials as well. Go ahead.
Between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state.
No. We covered all that. So we're in the next paragraph below that. There you go. Yep. Mm-hmm.
In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, and those in which a state shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction.
Stop.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that's where they're saying in these types of cases, they have original jurisdiction. As long as it won, because these things have been defined and outside of it arising under the Constitution, we already kind of know that the federal executive has the ability to receive ambassadors and create ambassadors. So this is why they, you know, the Supreme Court will have this jurisdiction because it does arise under the Constitution. And those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In other words, it's those things that arise under the Constitution, that if a state is a party to it and it's something that arises under the Constitution, they have, as it says, original jurisdiction. So in other words, you don't have to go to a federal court, you know, a district court. You can go straight to the Supreme Court in these cases. Okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. So now the next statement, go ahead.
In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
So in other words, everything else under the Constitution that they have this jurisdiction, all things arising under the Constitution. I'll give you a case in point. If a convention of states is to arise, if all of a sudden the states, you know, get 34 states to pursue a convention of states, and Congress, now that we have 34 states engaged in standing up this convention, and Congress comes along and says, we're going to regulate you, and these states come along and say, you can't do that. And the Congress will say, it doesn't say we can't do that in Article 5. And then they'll say, well, we kind of have the ruling as it was set before. Well, hold on here. As set before, the convention that was created, the Constitutional Convention, the Articles of Confederation did not include that convention. That was left to the states to do. Now we're funding this convention. And therefore, it falls under our purview. It arises under the Constitution. And therefore, we're suing you if you don't let us regulate you. And it will go to the court. And guess what? It arises under the Constitution. And ergo, the court can actually rule that it does arise, and Congress can regulate you in how you will conduct this convention. Because there's no clear language in the Constitution that they can't do it. Actually, the clear language is that anything arising under this Constitution, the court has jurisdiction. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So that's why it's very, very dangerous to actually go into this convention, because even though the idiots in Congress don't know these things, I would assume, and I would presume, instead of assume, I would presume that lawyers, these creatures that exist for aggrandizing themselves, would say, hey, this is something, because everything, as far as they're concerned, can be pulled into the Constitution. And if the states try to say, hey, you don't have jurisdiction, I'm sorry, it actually does arise under the Constitution. And they will actually win that case. And yeah. Nobody in the Constitutional Convention argument from the John Birchers or the Convention of States have ever put this on the table. That, yeah, we take a risk of this evil self, because, you know, the whole point of the convention is to stop the federal government from assuming control. That's what the impetus that the convention states, hey, government's out of control. They can't prove that the Constitution is the problem. They can't point to a defect and say, we got to get rid of this one line. That is the problem right there. That's not. The reality is everybody accepts that the federal government is functioning outside their powers. They're assuming powers and so forth. Therefore, they're trying to create an amendment that can help contain them better. When reality, we know that the only process, based on Madison and Jefferson, the only process of actually fixing the problem isn't creating an amendment. The problem is interposing and forcing the federal government into compliance. We have everything we need in the Constitution to start removing these people and demand we will actually get the compliance when we finally get rid of enough of these scoundrels and put the right people in that will actually support their oath in office. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So we're being manipulated in all of these different capacities to become binary. You either are for the convention or against the convention. Well, how about let's be for the Constitution and demand compliance of the Constitution? That's why I say at the beginning of every show, folks, it's all about compliance of the Constitution. Don't be dragged in to these stupid arguments and take a side. We have to demand that everybody demand compliance of the Constitution first, which means the Articles, the Convention of State Action, folks, and all these different groups that are out there calling for a convention or calling for not stopping the convention, force them all to say, basically say, we need to get compliance. Quit arguing and let's all unite in getting the federal government to comply. Get rid of the things that they're doing. That's the whole problem. So, okay, the next paragraph and the last paragraph right here, because this is the jurisdiction over that little thing we talk about, the impeachment of the president, which is very unique to all other public offices. Go ahead.
The trial of all crimes, except in the cases of impeachment, shall be by jury.
Okay, and so you keep going, because this is kind of all combined to this thing. Go ahead.
And such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. But when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed.
Okay, so it says right here, the trial of all crimes. What crimes does the federal government have jurisdiction over? It's only four.
Piracy,
counterfeiting. Treason, and laws against the, crimes committed against the laws of nations.
Laws of nations.
There you go. So two of those, piracy and laws of nations, is crimes that are committed outside the United States. So the only two crimes that a person can commit that could actually be tried by the federal government is counterfeiting and treason. That's it. Now, if you look at the amendments, there's no amendment that actually establishes a new crime. We had an amendment that actually created a crime, which was the Prohibition Amendment, that you couldn't produce alcohol, which means the federal government could actually define what the punishment and all of that stuff was. But guess what? We repealed it. So that crime went off the table. So now it's back down to two. And when they created this Prohibition Amendment, they created the FBI and the ATF. And instantly, when they got rid of the Prohibition Amendment, one would think that they would disband that entity. Because what else is it going to do? But they didn't.
Funny how that never happens.
Yeah, but they didn't. And then, over time, they started actually assuming new criminal law, like drugs are illegal. Or kidnapping across state lines. All of these things, which really, I mean, nobody wants to see criminals getting away with this type of stuff. But the question is, do we want the federal government to have that power, or do we want to fix the Constitution so the states will have that power? And I say we empower the states instead of the federal government. The federal government is very good at fighting and waging warfare. And we're talking about strategic, real devious things that you have to do to take, land and take, a country out. We do not want the federal government to have the power to take a state out or to take people out. We want to make sure that those guns never turn inward on us. Which is why Madison stated clearly that the design was the federal government would be outward facing and that the states would deal with all things domestic. So what we actually have to do, based on what Madison said, is we need to actually look at changing the Constitution, granting the ability of the states to organize, to basically be able to work together to go after kidnappers and those types of things. Shut down the FBI and put those things into this new domestic domestic law enforcement agency that the states control instead of the federal government. That makes sense, right?
Yes, it does.
There you
go. And that's, I just wanted to comment, it's easier for an enemy to take over a nation if they can capture the federal government, if the federal government has power over all of the people. But right. The beauty of our system is the independent sovereign states, where we can come to each other's aid, we can work together, but no one can control all of the states from one central, you know, entity. And I think that's part of the problem of why we had the issue we had today with the immigration topic, right. Because the federal government was bringing in invaders. So if you get tyrannical people with evil, nefarious agendas, and they get control of the federal government, and they don't have the Constitution to bind them, then right. They can do all these horrible things that we've allowed to happen.
And we've proven that the federal government has no jurisdiction over immigration or the importation of persons. The only thing they have in Article 1, Section 9, is the ability to regulate states' importation of persons. That's it. They can't import people. They can't bring in refugees. That power was never given to them. Only the states knew what would be best for them, and they did not grant the federal government to be able to bring bad players into the states. The states had full control over their own destiny and over who came into them. It was that clear. Jefferson pointed this out in the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. He says, you don't have that power. And the only power you're going to get is in 1808, the ability to shut down states' importation of persons. You still won't be able to bring people in and have control over them. So the point is that we have to actually look whether they really possess. The only thing the federal government has is to make a uniform rule of naturalization. That's it. As we look at all of these things, you know, it's almost like the devious evil kid that you knew, that you hated to play with, because he would always make up the rules as he goes along. That's the federal government. They're making it up as they go along, and they've looked in advance and created the strategies of what they need to do. We're going to create this problem, and then we'll assume this. We're going to create this problem and assume this. Robert Higgs, an economist, talks about From Crisis to Leviathan and the Ratcheting Effect. It's a very good book. You can get it in an audio or what have you, but he literally points out how the federal government has allowed problems to actually percolate and be created, and then they come along with a regulation, and they come along with this great, hey, we'll take care of this for you. And the states go, oh, thank you, you're the greatest. And like you said, they've assumed and assumed and assumed. They don't have the legitimate authority to do these things. And the states can easily stand up and say, it ends today. And it would. All the states have to do is actually start removing public servants. See, this is the devil that nobody wants to talk about, because when a politician tells you that anybody can be removed if they violate their oath of supporting the Constitution, because they believe that they're equally guilty of doing it, that everybody would be removed. I actually had politicians in Wyoming in 2020 during the party convention in Gillette. So I went to Gillette, participated in this big convention, and I was not accosted, but I was grabbed by about 8 legislators in the state legislature, because they were aware of what I was doing, trying to invoke this Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and all of this. And they all basically said, hey, GR, we love the Constitution, but we just don't understand it. We know we're probably guilty of violating because we don't understand it. And we're afraid of having to invoke that. And I said, you know, I just smiled and I say, I understand your understanding is limited, but when you create this committee, this Constitutional Compliance Committee, that you will have control over anything and everything you do, you can actually run to the committee and say, is this legitimate? Is it constitutional? You will never cross that boundary ever again. And they kind of looked, you know what? They didn't like that answer because they like the political theatrics and the ability to compromise. And folks, that's how they've been selling us downriver. And though these guys may have been good, their compromises were for the conservative control, the unconstitutional control of the people for conservative purposes, not for liberal purposes, if you know, perverting your kids. Now we want to make sure your kids are Christian. So in other words, when you really look at the conservatives and the progressives, they're just two sides of the same coin. One is the moral, you know, control over people, and the other one is the immoral control over people. And that's what they're fighting for. Instead of actually getting government into its limited capacity and functioning within those limited roles, powers, responsibilities, and so forth that we've granted them. It's really that simple. And we've got to stop allowing them to create this paradigm of conservative and progressive. We got to hold them to, is it constitutional? Can you even be involved in that? And they don't like having to figure out, well, what do we do? What do we do when we get rid of the education system? We can create a better system. And there's ways of doing that. But, you know, that's for a different time and place. We got 2 minutes left. And so we have, we covered this whole point on the trial. So now we're in Section 3, and we've kind of covered, or no, we haven't covered treason. We've talked about it, but let's go ahead and read this very first part, and we will go into probably the break talking about it, but let's go ahead.
Section 3, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court.
Okay, so that right there, in other words, levying war against them. So in other words, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. So in other words, it's treason. As a matter of fact, let's be clear here. The first trial of treason was over what? We haven't covered it yet. You will cover it with me in a couple of weeks.
Whiskey taxes.
The Whiskey Rebellion. In other words, these people rebelled against the laws of the Union that were constitutional. And 24 men were arrested. They were dragged back into D.C., and they were tried on treason. They weren't tried on violating the law for committing that crime. It was the crime of treason. And so they were dragged into D.C. I don't know. Maybe the case was held in Pennsylvania because Pennsylvania was just around the corner. And so, and actually, I don't think D.C. had the buildings that stood up yet because George Washington was in office. So they were in Pennsylvania at the time because that's the first 2 years was up in New York and the rest until D.C. was created was down in Philadelphia. So they were in D.C., or I should say they were in Pennsylvania for the trial of treason. And two men were convicted of treason for rebelling against a constitutional law. There you go. With that. Wow. So we can talk about that when we come back because we can make a note of that and then cover the last paragraph of Section 3 of Article 3, which is kind of the punishment and all of that. But anyway, folks, we're really helping you see that there's only very few things that they can legitimately do. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.